vote now.
All right, register to vote.
Your vote matters.
Your vote matters.
You get out there and make your voice heard.
You want people to vote, right?
You can bet.
Oh, really?
She's going to vote.
Voting mi gente, voting mi gente.
Truth is where you find it.
We need to knock on every door. We need to get out every vote.
You're going to vote, right? Because I'm really scared.
It's around this time of year that we hear the calls to get out to vote. Your vote matters. Each vote makes a difference and can change the future of this country. Vote or die. And yet, so many of us don't do it. In a presidential election year, 40% of Americans do not vote. In a midterm year like this one, it's closer to 60%. Think about that. Fewer than half of eligible voters in the United States will decide who gets elected to the House, Senate, and other key political positions throughout the country. Fewer than half. Are you one of them?
Hi, my name is Camille Lacey. I live in Brooklyn, New York, and I don't vote because I don't believe the system is truly a democracy. I advocate for direct democracy, where our representatives are held directly accountable and can be recalled at any time and are of the people. So I don't see any point in taking time out of a busy day.
Camille is not alone. Lots of you told us you just don't believe in the system. So why participate?
I am a highly successful taxpaying citizen, 38 years old, and I have never even registered to vote. Frankly speaking, I'm too busy out working and making a living to educate myself on these charlatans.
Hey, my name's Nick, 21 years old. I don't feel like voting makes that big of a difference anymore. I feel like the outcome is going to be the outcome no matter what. Elections aren't something to trust.
Others said that there just aren't candidates that represent what you believe.
Hi, this is Ben from Portland, Oregon. I'm 33 years old, and I've never voted for any national political campaign simply because I don't think that the candidates they're giving us are that great. I mean, Hillary Clinton was flawed, and Donald Trump is a disaster. Stop voting for these morons.
Then here's a response I wasn't expecting.
This is Mary from Philadelphia. I know you're going to find this hard to believe, but for many years I did not vote so that my name would not appear on the rolls for jury duty. It wasn't until years later that I started voting again.
But more than anything, we heard from people like Cindy and Alex, who are just so turned off by the current state of politics, they'd rather just sit it out.
The reason I don't vote is because I am so overly inundated with politics on a daily level that I have completely lost interest and would rather live my life and get on with it.
Yes, I can vote to answer your question, but most times I don't. What would make me return to the polls? How about some honesty? How about a modicum of morality and people not filling their pockets with taxpayers' money? Politics is really just a bad joke.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Amy Walter is on vacation this week. On today's show, a look at non-voters, the people who can vote and choose not to, and the people who would love to vote but can't. And we'll find out if there are ways to engage more Americans in the most important part of our democracy, the act of voting. We begin the hour with why so few eligible voters exercise this right.
One of the best predictors of whether a person will vote is their age.
That's Barry Burden, a professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
A rough rule of thumb is that your likelihood of voting goes up about a percentage point each year. So in a presidential election, something like 30% of 30-year-olds would vote and something like 60% of 60-year-olds would vote. And that comes from a variety of things. It comes from getting registered and being on the rolls. And then once a person establishes a voting habit, they tend to stay registered. It's a result of being rooted in a place. People sort of settle down in terms of where they live and become connected to their community, and that will often boost voter turnout. And then there are life events like getting married, having children, settling into a career that often encourage people to vote.
So that makes sense, right? I mean, the more settled you are in a place and the more you form a habit of voting, the more likely you are to invest in your community and become a more active voter. I know that's been true for me personally. But what else is going on here? We heard a range of reasons from the non-voters in our audience, from thinking that the system is rigged to feeling that their vote just doesn't matter.
Any theory you have about why people don't vote, you can find people who feel that way.
David Nickerson is an associate professor of political science at Temple University, and he explains why the voter turnout is the way it is in this country.
A lot of it's that people aren't in the habit of voting, where people who vote routinely will continue to vote, and that's not much of a surprise. But for young people, you know, they're not in the habit of voting. They're brand new. So they haven't had the opportunity. They're not in that habit. Furthermore, you know, voting is a social norm that is enforced by people, you know, with the expectation that your peers will vote. And if you are a college-educated professional who lives in the suburbs, you're probably mostly interacting with other voters. Whereas if you're a younger person who lives in the city, chances are a lot of your friends aren't voting. And so you don't get that self-reinforcing of, you know, a group identity of like, oh, we need to be voting. This is just expected of you.
You've studied that voting could be contagious in households. What does that mean?
So it means that the norm of voting and reinforcing that norm is something that takes place in social networks. And I measured the household in this case, where I saw that if you mobilize one person to vote in the household, that will transfer to the other person in the household.
Can you tell me a little more about that study? I mean, how did you measure that effect?
So the study looked at households containing two registered voters, and they were randomly assigned to one of three conditions. One condition was a control where we didn't talk to them. Another condition was where we knocked on the door and tried to talk to them about recycling and didn't ask them to vote or talk about anything other than recycling. And the third condition asked them to please vote in the upcoming primary election. And we could look at the person who answered the door in the placebo condition about recycling and the please vote condition and see that the increase in turnout was 8 to 10 points, depending on what city we're looking at. The interesting thing was when we looked at the other person in the household who the canvasser did not talk to at all, and we saw that their turnout was also about 6 points higher. So that meant that about two-thirds of the mobilization effect from the door knock was passed on to the other person in the household. There's been some evidence that you see this in broader social networks. For instance, there's the Bond et al. Piece in Nature where they show some evidence that there's a contagion of voting across Facebook networks.
Right. I've been curious. Like, when you see a Facebook post from a friend with an I voted sticker, does that actually do anything?
Yeah. I mean, the effect is small, though. I mean, because birds of a feather tend to flock together, and you often have people who vote, and the type of person who's so committed they'll take a picture of themselves with the I voted sticker often mostly have friends who have similar views. So the trick is to reach out to the people in your social network who do not have those views and are unlikely to vote and try to apply pressure for them to vote.
And is that something you think is most effectively done, as you mentioned, on the individual or in the societal, like in my social networks? Or is that something that, you know, these bigger initiatives like we're seeing coming out of the students at Parkland, for example, who are trying to increase young people, you know, registration of young people voting. Like, can it be, is it more effective to encourage people to vote when you know them personally, or is it more effective to come up with large scale voter registration techniques, et cetera?
All of the above. So in terms of like in person, it's always more effective to talk to people you know. Like if you think about like someone's going to come ask you for money for a charity that you probably support, if it's your friend, you're going to have a harder time getting out of that because you know them personally, there's an established relationship, you trust them and you feel an obligation. Whereas, you know, the college student who's got the summer internship to walk around and raise money, it's pretty easy to say no thank you and close the door. So the personal touch definitely matters. In a broader level, the efforts to change laws to make registration easier and turnout easier seem a more promising way to go. It's a lot of work to knock on doors and register voters. Whereas, you know, in the state of Washington and Oregon, if you get a driver's license, you have to opt out of being registered to vote, which means that we'll bring more people into being registered. Now, some of those people may not be interested in politics and may not ultimately participate, but you've just removed another barrier to them voting.
What about just trust in the system? We're obviously in a moment where there are many concerns, some valid, some not valid, about the extent to which our voting system was impacted by foreign power. Do you think things like that will turn people off? They might not feel confident in our system and they might say, you know what, not going to go do it.
I think that's pretty unlikely. I think when people worry about trust in the system, it's a more generalized sense that the government can do things to make life better, so that your vote is changing the world. When I went canvassing and you talk to people who may not vote, sometimes they hear like, well, why do I care? Because it doesn't matter who's in charge, nothing happens. And there's a disconnect between the act of voting, and even if you win the election, your candidate wins, they have to get it through. And their system of checks and balances, that's often very complicated. And the party, the presidency, or the governor can't just wave a magic wand and make policy happen. There's a lot of things that happen. And so people become disillusioned as to whether or not this matters. You also tend to hear negative stories about the government. I mean, it would not make a very good headline to say, like, you know, budget is clean and has no signs of irregularities, right? That'd be the most boring headline ever. Whereas, you know, irregularities in budget looks like there's corruption, that's more likely to get attention. So you tend to only hear negative stories about government. And when things are working, it's just too boring to report.
Although I will say, given the news cycle lately, we'd be grateful for a story that was boring and straightforward. you know, what if we could see 90% of the population voting, or let's say in a presidential year, or maybe bring that 40% in congressional years up to 80%? What kind of change would that actually have, if any?
So some of the research would suggest there wouldn't be much, whether it be Adam Berinsky's book on the silent majority, or like Jack Citrin and John Seid's work looking at the attitudes of non-voters. When they look at surveys and look at the attitudes of the people who report not voting to the people who vote, they look pretty similar. And so that if you were to say, well, what if these non-voters actually participated, nothing would change in the elections. But if you look, you know, across other countries, you might think that since, say, young people systematically vote less, that there might be more attention paid to education and debt and jobs programs, and maybe a little less attention paid to, say, retirement programs. But that's almost a theoretical construct because we can't really get good data on that.
David Nickerson is Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University. David, thanks.
Thank you very much.
It's been 53 years since Congress passed the Voting Rights Act, which outlawed the discriminatory practices keeping people of color from the polls.
The understanding clause, where you had to read a part of the Constitution to the satisfaction of a registrar and demonstrate that you understood the state constitution, poll taxes, literacy requirements, and violence. African Americans in the South essentially were entirely disenfranchised.
That's Sherrilyn Ifill, president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. She says when the Voting Rights Act was passed, things began to improve. That's in large part thanks to a section of the act that required something called preclearance, requiring jurisdictions with a history of voting discrimination to submit changes to their voting system to a federal authority.
If they want to expand the county council, if they want to move polling places, if they want to change registration requirements.
It all used to require clearance, that is, until 2013, and the case of Shelby County v. Holder.
The Supreme Court, in a really devastating 5-4 decision, strikes down this preclearance provision that I've described as being so central to the power of the Voting Rights Act because it stops discrimination before it happens. If you read the opinion, it's essentially the Chief Justice and the majority essentially saying that they think it's no longer necessary, that it's a new day. And of course, the result, Tanzina, is precisely what we expected and what we told the Supreme Court was likely to happen. A wave of voter suppression laws that have been unleashed in this country since the Supreme Court's decision in 2013.
Sherrilyn, let's bring the picture to today. We are obviously just a couple of months away from the midterm elections. Can you give us a snapshot of where voting rights stand in our country today? We just mentioned voter suppression. I recall last year around the election, presidential election, that there were many threats at the polls. There's many reports about purging voters from the rolls. I mean, where are we in your estimation today?
In my view, we're in almost a perfect storm of a threat to the ongoing integrity of our election system. It begins with the kinds of voter suppression laws that I referred to. The day of the Shelby decision, the Secretary of State of Florida said, you know, we're free and clear now. the Secretary of State and Attorney General of Texas indicated their intention by tweet within hours of the Shelby decision to try and re-up a voter ID law that they had attempted to pre-clear prior to the Shelby decision and in which pre-clearance had been denied. And they did re-up that law. They did enact that law, the most restrictive voter ID law in the country, which we then challenged in court. And a federal district court, a trial court, found that the law was passed for the purpose of discriminating against African-American and Latino voters. In North Carolina, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals found that an omnibus voter suppression law passed in that state following the Shelby decision was enacted, and the provisions were created with surgical precision designed to disenfranchise African-American voters. When you add to that the fact that we no longer have the preclearance provision, which means that polling place changes and changes to early voting and registration changes and polling machine allocation, all of these are intensely local decisions that happen at the micro level in our country because we do not have a national system of voting. And without preclearance, we now lack the ability to keep up with those changes as they happen in real time. And so we're almost always litigating, challenging something that's already happened rather than stopping something before it happens. And then finally, you have to add in it the revelations of Russian interference in our elections. The truth is we know that Russian operatives hacked into the election system. We don't know exactly what they did, but what we do know is by the admission of the president of Russia at the Helsinki press conference, that the intention was to try and help Donald Trump win the election, which means that the targeting of the activities were designed to get at those voters who would be most reliably unlikely to vote for Donald Trump. And given racial politics in this country, everyone is very well aware that African American voters, at least at this point in the country, are overwhelmingly voting with the Democratic Party. We also know that Facebook was infiltrated by operatives as well, who used racial appeals to, in some instances, keep African Americans from voting, stoke concerns about African Americans through posts that falsely were attributed to Black Lives Matter, that tried to stoke prejudice against Muslim American groups. So we're almost in a perfect storm in which we have domestic voter suppression based on racial discrimination, and we have the exploitation of our ongoing problem of racial discrimination by foreign operatives infiltrating our election system. And the worst part of this is, Tanzina, we have no comprehensive plan announced by the United States Congress to address any of this.
Are you concerned about people's safety at the polls? Are you concerned that their votes may or may not register? Are you concerned that people might not even show up? Because that's a big part of what we're talking about on this show, is not only those who can't vote and are disenfranchised, but those who just choose not to participate in the process at all for a variety of reasons, including perhaps many of the ones that we've just talked about.
Well, I think you're hitting on all the right points. I hope and believe that one of the things that's happened over the last year is an awakening of people to understand how critical it is that they do show up and vote. And I think that some of the preliminary information we're seeing in some of the primary and special elections that have happened since November 2016 demonstrate that people do recognize the importance of coming out to vote. And I'm happy to see that across the board. But what I am concerned about is all of the things that you mentioned. At the Legal Defense Fund, we understand the kind of minute voter suppression and disenfranchisement that can happen. It can happen when there are voter purges and people show up at the polls who've been voting for 25 years and suddenly they're no longer on the list. We see what happens when the wrong election machines somehow make their way to polling places in the African American community. We see when county election officials fail to allocate sufficient voting machines to polling places in African American communities. We see when there are confusing ballots that are generated that make it very difficult for voters to understand how to physically cast the ballot. We see poll watchers who provide erroneous information to voters about whether they can vote by a real ballot or a provisional ballot. It requires our constant and aggressive vigilance to do something that, you know, should have been resolved 150 years ago with the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, certainly was on the path to being resolved after the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. We have still had to lean in heavily in the 53 years since then, but perhaps never more so than during the period we're currently in.
Sherrilyn Ifill is the president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Sherrilyn, thank you so much.
Thank you.
One disenfranchised group, those with felony convictions. According to the Sentencing Project, there are more than 6 million Americans who can't vote because of a felony conviction. And because of the way our prison population breaks down by race, it means that one in every 13 Black adults cannot vote. Devin Coleman is one of them. In 1999, when he was a senior in college studying economics, he attended a house party where a fight ensued. Two men were injured and some items were stolen. He took a plea deal and pleaded guilty to grand jury theft and burglary and spent 2.5 years in prison. After he was released, he was sent back to prison for violating his parole. When he finally got out, the 2006 midterm elections were approaching.
Even after I paid my debt, I lost my right to vote. It was a letter sent saying that I can't go vote. And I was like, what? I can't vote? And that's when I realized that due to the conviction in 2001, I wasn't able to vote.
When you realized that, do you remember how you felt?
Yeah, I was numb. I was numb because at that point, I was realizing this conviction was going to follow me for a long time. And it was affecting every aspect of my life.
Are you able to vote today?
No.
Tell me about how that makes you feel, because this is now a couple years since you've been out.
Right. As a matter of fact, August 16th will be 12 years for me. And it's a terrible feeling. I paid the debt to society. Then I come home, and when we look at the process Florida has to restore voting rights, it doesn't take into account the person that I am 12 years later. It always looks back at who I was or the things that I was involved with, and it's 12 years distance between me and that person. And that's very discouraging when you look at the things that I did since I've been home from incarceration.
Since being home, Devin finished college and got his degree. Today, he's a father and a taxpaying American, and he works as the communications director for the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, where he fights to change the laws that disenfranchise felons.
Our main goal is to end the discrimination and disenfranchisement of individuals with past felony convictions. And voting is a major component in that. We believe in the right to vote itself, in the right to vote for each individual to vote for whoever they see fit to vote for. We fighting for the voice of the individual to use however they choose.
Now, I'm wondering if the right to vote has any impact on recidivism rates. If people feel more involved in their community, are they more likely to get out of the criminal world?
Yes. Yes. The Florida Parole Commission actually did a study on a group of individuals that had their voting rights restored, and they had a significantly lower recidivism rate than those who didn't. So restoring voting rights does create safer communities.
Why does this matter, Devin? Why do you think it's so important for people to be able to vote? There's some people that we're interviewing for this show who say, you know what? I can vote. I just don't want to.
You know, it's a saying that people don't know what they have until they lose it. And thinking about it, I think about now at this age, I think about all my family members and friends that serve in the military, and they go out and they stand up and they put their life on the line for all Americans. So one of the key points of being American, of participating in the democracy that we have, is the ability to vote. So if you can't vote, you're not included in that process. And that's a hurtful feeling. I think people need to go back and look at how many groups fought and gave their life to have the opportunity to vote and get back to what voting really means, and let that fuel them to go vote, if not for themselves, for the people that can't vote, for the people that died so they could have the right to vote, for the people that sacrificed and put their life on the line so all citizens would be able to vote.
Devin Coleman is communications director for the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, who was also disenfranchised after a felony conviction. Devin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Now we turn to another person who can't vote in the U.S., but for a different reason. Tolu Alishinloye is a DACA recipient living in New York City.
My parents came from Nigeria, and they brought me here when I was 3 years old. They arrived on visiting visas legally, which later expired, and they weren't able to adjust status. I grew up here just like every other child. I lost my first teeth here. I learned the Star Spangled Banner here. I did the whole, you know, elementary, middle school, high school here. I actually went to a boarding school where I earned a scholarship to attend college.
It wasn't until Tolu was looking to go to college that she learned she was undocumented, and that meant she was unable to vote.
It was truly like a case of mistaken identity. It was just like somebody knocked the wind out of me.
Today, she wants people to hear her story and get inspired to vote, and here's why.
Rewind to last year when President Trump ended the DACA program. I don't think people realize the implications that that had on DACA recipients who are already in the program. So I literally had to take a leave of absence from work because I no longer was able to renew my DACA. So it was September. My DACA was ending in March. Congress, you know, had to, you know, act in order to put something into law. So it really matters who's in place in the Senate, who's in place in Congress. It really matters who's sitting in the president's seat, quite honestly. And I think I had a lot of friends who just don't really think it matters. And I've had to explain to them, you know, I can't vote. Like, these are things that are truly affecting me and my day-to-day life. And I'm not able to, you know, exercise that right. I pay into taxes. I am not able to get unemployment. You know, there's a lot of things that I pay into, and I don't have a right to have access to, you know, those benefits. And the other thing people don't realize is if you're a DACA recipient, you can't leave the country. So you're almost trapped inside the country. You're not able to. I haven't seen my mom in 6 years, and she lives outside the country.
Oh my
gosh,
wow.
I think people don't realize the impact that it's had on, you know, just psychologically walking around and not knowing your fate, not knowing not only if you can work, but when will you be able to see your family members? If something were to happen outside the country, do you forfeit the opportunity to come back? So I think it's really frustrating when I hear people say that they aren't going to vote or they don't think it matters, because this truly does impact people's lives directly.
And so is there, I mean, we're obviously right now we're in a very politicized moment in the United States. We're in a very tense civil moment in this country. Would you have wanted to vote, you know, prior to this administration, for example?
Oh, 100%.
Is it this administration that was the thing that said, you know what, I want to get into this? Or is it just being able to participate in the process?
I've always wanted to participate, you know. I mean, I was there celebrating with people, you know, during other elections. And, you know, I didn't have any, you know, I can't tell my grandkids that I voted for President Obama. You know, I haven't been a part of that. It's like I'm a part of this society. I'm a part of it in every way, but, you know, very important ways. And I think more than ever now, I think right now, because there's so much chaos going on, I think people think it's a false choice. I think some people are standing back because they feel like if you vote for DACA, that means you don't believe in voting for healthcare, or do you believe in jobs for, you know, American citizens. And I think, you know, people need to lean in a little more and just, you know, find out what's going on directly near you.
We have a low turnout rate for presidential elections, but midterm elections are often even worse.
Yep.
There's a midterm election coming up less than 100 days from now. It could be critical for this country, and there may be people who don't want to vote. Do you have a message for those people who are not going to vote?
Absolutely.
Or who may not turn out to vote?
Absolutely. So I think it's really important for people to understand how these local elections impact them. We're talking about judges. We're talking about people who directly impact. If we're talking about police reform and those types of things that are having these headlines that we're seeing on a day-to-day basis, that's where the impact is going to be really felt. And I think people sitting on the sidelines during, you know, these key issues and then being really upset. And these protests are amazing. I think the things that we've been doing, it's been such great momentum. But I think we have to really tie the bow on everything that we've been doing and all the hard work by making sure that we vote in the people that are going to have our best interests at heart on a local level.
Tolu Alishinloye, DACA recipient living in New York City. She's also a mover for the project The Love Vote. And we'll tell you all about what that is coming up. Tolu, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Progressive Insurance, offering its Home Quote Explorer, designed to provide information about available home insurance options in one place. More information at progressive.com.
Voting I think, really became important to me in 2008 because it felt like history was happening and I wasn't really a part of it.
Esther the Rothschild is an educator and filmmaker, and she came to the United States from France when she was a young child, but only sought citizenship in the U.S. recently when she was in her 30s.
I became a citizen partly because I really wanted to vote. I also wanted to do jury duty, which I haven't gotten a chance to do yet, but I have been able to vote, and it's been really emotional for me.
Esther's behind a new project which aims to give a voice to those who still cannot vote in the U.S., and it's called the Love Vote. And what it does is it lets those people who can't vote encourage others to pledge to vote on their behalf by sharing their stories. The idea came to Esther last year.
I was teaching filmmaking to high school students at a school near here, and some students were expressing their frustration at the end of the last school year about the fact that they had to live with the consequences of other people's decisions, both the votes that people had cast and the people who had stayed home. And they weren't old enough to vote. And that resonated with me because I knew how that felt.
Tolu Alashinloye, the DACA recipient we heard from a few minutes ago, is one of the Love Vote's so-called movers, meaning she shared her story on the project site in the hopes of inspiring others to vote. She says it's having an impact.
I've had friends of mine who did not know my story, had no idea, they had no connection to DACA, they had no idea, you know, that any of this impacted people directly, and they've promised me that they would vote.
I asked the Love Vote founder, Esther de Rothschild, to explain the project and why she believes it could be a powerful tool in the midterms.
The Love Vote is a platform for the 50 million Americans who can't vote to share their stories and move other people to vote on their behalf. Whether they're too young or not citizens or disenfranchised, they can explain why they would vote if they could, why it matters to them that people in their community show up, and then others promise to vote on their behalf. And in that way, they increase voter turnout with love.
So when you're saying vote on their behalf, it means that if I support a specific candidate, you would vote for that candidate, or you vote on my issue, or how does it work exactly?
No, we don't ask people to vote a certain kind of way, because ultimately someone's vote is their own. They have one vote. It's just that so many people don't vote at all. We know that 108 million people didn't vote in the last presidential election. Two-thirds of voters didn't vote in the last midterm elections. And so if someone shares their story and they say, this is really what matters to me, not a candidate, but just this is why I wish I could vote, it might not matter to you. You might not believe in the system. I'm not trying to change your mind. I'm just saying that I might be facing deportation, or I'm not sure how I'm going to pay for college, or this really matters to me. And just out of love for me, will you show up and vote? And I'm not going to tell you how to vote because I trust you're from my community. You'll have my best interest in mind. But just show up. Let us be heard as a community. Because voting, it's not really an individual act. It is a communal act. What you do impacts other people. And so we're trying to reframe voting as an act of love, as a communal act.
What's the response been so far?
So far, the response has been really nice. We have shared stories of over 20 movers. People who can't vote are called movers because they move other people to go to the polls. And a lot of movers have said that they felt really seen and heard and cared for and empowered. And then voters, some people who would have voted anyway will still promise to vote as a sign of solidarity. But there have been many people who said, I wouldn't have voted otherwise, but I love Alex. I'm not going to let her down. I'm going to show up this time. Mm-hmm. And because our website, it's set up like a crowdfunding site. We didn't want to just have a YouTube channel with videos that people might see and forget about. So every mover shares their story. They set a goal for how many votes they want to raise. And then other people, when they watch this video, they click on a promise button, promise to vote on behalf of that mover. And then we follow up with them, letting them know when their election is coming up, where and when and how to vote, and help them keep their promise.
You mentioned, we talked about at the top of the segment about how few people vote in the United States, just in general, whether especially in those that can vote. And I guess if we're looking at those numbers in presidential elections, midterm elections, which is what we have coming up, now are even less popular among voters.
What do you think, if any, impact will this project have on the midterm elections? Or what are you hoping for at the midterms? Because that's really where people don't come out to the polls.
Right. Only a third of people voted the last time, in the last midterm elections in 2014. And generally in mayoral elections, it's about 15% turnout, about a third for congressional elections. And these things really, really matter. And a lot of the communities that movers come from, immigrant communities, communities impacted by mass incarceration, and young communities are very underrepresented, particularly in these local elections. So we're hoping to drive turnout from people who would not have voted otherwise. And we're hoping that also people keep in mind particular issues impacting immigrants, impacting people who have been disenfranchised, impacting young people when they go to the polls. They can make their own mind up, ultimately, of course, about who to vote for, but that they vote with an open heart and keeping other people in mind.
Why do you think it's so hard to get Americans to vote or to incentivize Americans who can vote to vote when those who don't have the ability to vote would give so much to be able to do that?
I think there's a lot of structural barriers, first of all. Now there are more and more barriers being thrown up, people taken off the voter rolls, requiring expensive ID. I mean, $30 might not seem expensive, but for a lot of people, that's a barrier to voting. And so we might not have poll taxes and literacy tests, but essentially we still do. So I don't think that there should be any shaming of people who don't vote because there are factors making it difficult for them. And then often people don't feel inspired, or they feel that there's not a candidate that truly represents them. And I think that something we're trying to show is there might not be a difference between these candidates for you, but for me, it's a difference between being reunited with my family or not, right? For me, it may be a life or death difference if I'm deported back to a place where a gang wants to kill me. But for many Americans, they might not actually see the difference that they're being asked to choose between. And also, I think in some ways, it's such a huge country. There's over 300 million of us. And I was taught that if you're in danger and you're shouting for help, point to one person, because I think it's called the diffusion of responsibility if you shout into a crowd. And so there's a sense of, well, I'm busy on Tuesday, but other people will show up. And I think if we realize someone is counting on me, my niece, my coworker, my neighbor has asked me to do it, it's like pointing to someone on a platform and saying, show up for me.
Esther DeRosschild is an educator, filmmaker, and founder of The Love Vote. Esther, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's The Takeaway, and we've spent the hour talking about people who can't vote or simply don't. So finally today, can we change this picture? Can we get more eligible voters to the polls? What would it take, and what methods already exist? I asked Barry Burden, and he is a professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Well, there are a lot of different things being tried across the states, but there really is one reform that has been proven in research over the years to increase turnout in a very consistent fashion, and that is Election Day registration. That's the practice that allows a person to both register and vote, usually on the spot in one place on election day. So they're getting on the rolls and they're casting a ballot all at once. It's really helpful for people who change their names and addresses. And increasingly, this is a large share of the American electorate. We know the electorate is mobile, especially young people. They just move more often than older people. There's some recent research showing that election day registration boosts overall turnout by just a few percentage points, but it has a really big effect for young people, maybe by double digits, increasing their turnout.
Well, there's another form of registering people to vote, which is automatic voter registration. I've heard of this concept. Tell us more about it.
Yeah, this is a little more radical. It's a kind of aggressive idea that really has been pushed hardest just in the last couple of years. Oregon was the state that was the real innovator in this area. The idea is that registration ought to be the responsibility of the state and not the responsibility of the voter. That's how it works in most of the developed world. The government is in charge of getting people on the rolls, and then those voters are in charge of getting out and casting ballots. That's not been the U.S. experience for most of American history. But now in Oregon and California and Illinois and some other places, the state has taken on the job of actually automatically registering as many people as they can, using information that the state already has, Typically, this would be from the DMV. We know from DMV records who lives where and whether they're citizens, whether they're of age. And so feeding that information right into the voter registration system can bring lots of people onto the rolls. And it looks like in Oregon, where it was used first in 2016, there was a pretty significant increase in obviously registration, but also in voter turnout.
I mean, these two things that you've just described, election day voting and automatic registration, seem like they should be apolitical and pretty straightforward. What is the holdup in getting more states to, particularly when it comes to automatic voter registration? Has it become politicized, in your opinion?
It has, unfortunately, like so many things in this area, really since the 2000 election meltdown, which we all remember in Florida, that led to some election reforms and really a higher level of partisanship in this area. We've seen states move in somewhat different directions depending on whether they trend blue or red. So it tends to be the blue states that have adopted these registration reforms on the West Coast and East Coast. And it tends to be other states that are redder that have some resistance. Either it's ideological or it's administrative, it's financial. Some are worried about the cost. So for whatever reason, the states are moving in somewhat different directions at the moment.
And I'm wondering, you know, we're talking a lot about the midterm elections, and we see even fewer people going to vote there than they do in presidential elections. Is there a way to increase turnout for these lesser known elections or the elections that we're less aware of or less interested in?
Well, one thing that would work well, but it's hard to control, is to make elections more interesting. We know that in states where there's a competitive race going on that's hard fought, turnout tends to be higher. That's definitely true in presidential election years, where some states in the Electoral College are really important because they're closely fought. These are swing states or battleground states like Ohio and Florida. And then there are other states that get no action at all. No visits from the candidates, no advertising, no phone calls, door knocks, or any of the other things that annoy voters in the swing states. But as a result, you get much higher levels of turnout in the states where voters are being engaged by the process and where they feel as though their vote matters. And you can't blame voters for not showing up when there just isn't much at stake. So you get a lot of inequality from one state to the next in the level of public engagement, just depending on what happens to be on the ballot on election day.
Barry, question for you about the concept of early voting. One of the things that research has also shown is that if people, because we only have one day to vote, that could potentially dissuade people from voting or not give people the opportunity because they have to go to work or because they just can't make it to the polls. Is early voting a solution?
Early voting has a lot of benefits, particularly for people who have work, school, family responsibilities on election day, they're traveling. But the research that my colleagues and I have done suggests that on its own does not increase turnout, and it might actually decrease turnout. And the reason is that it takes away the power that a single election day has to turn out lots of voters.
Is that because people say, well, I can do it tomorrow, I can do it the day after that, and then they forget to do it probably?
Humans work to deadlines, and so knowing that there's a final date is often what motivates people to take action. So having a week of early voting or a month of early voting probably doesn't add a lot in terms of bringing new people out. But having one day where it all happens really provides a lot of energy. It provides information. There's a lot of visual cues in a person's environment that voting is happening. Your school might be a polling place. Your workplace might be where voters are. You're likely to be contacted by parties and other groups to try to turn you out to vote. And so that stimulation will convert some people who are reluctant voters or maybe on the cusp of voting or not voting. It's enough of a nudge to bring them into the voting process. And that nudge gets weakened when the voting process is spread out over many days and places.
Mm. And is there something that you think we haven't tried yet that we should be trying, or some ideal solution to this problem, if you will, of low voter turnout?
Well, there are some really out-of-the-box ideas that have been tried in some other countries. I don't think many of them will fly in the United States, either because of legal or constitutional hurdles or just because the culture probably won't support it. For example, there are lots of countries that use compulsory voting that require voters to cast ballots and fine them if they don't vote. Australia might be the best-known example of this, but there are actually dozens of countries with this in place. They obviously get very high levels of turnout, 85, 90, 95% rates often. But I doubt that would ever be put in place in the U.S., both for legal reasons and just sort of cultural reasons about what Americans expect their government to do for them and to them. Probably the stopping point about halfway to that end would be to continue to modernize the voter registration system so that the rolls are sort of taken care of by the state automatically and are continually cleaned and maintained, and states are reaching out to voters when they think there's a concern about their record or they may be removed from the records for inactivity. Having that just kind of vigilance on the part of the government rather than on the part of the voter would be really helpful.
Barry Burden is a professor of political science and the director of the Elections Research Center at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Barry, thanks for being with us.
It was great to be with you.
And the final word this hour comes from you, both the voters and the non-voters out there.
This is David from Tacoma. I personally think that it is a right and it should be required for citizenship and federal benefits. If somebody is choosing not to vote, they're also choosing not to utilize social services.
I am eligible, and so are most of the people I work with to vote. The biggest hurdle for us is juggling our work schedule so everyone can go. A day off on election day would be a great incentive.
This is Alan from Brooklyn, New York. I'm currently 66 years old. I became eligible to vote 46 years ago. And to the best of my recollection, I have never missed a general or primary election since then.
Hi, this is Robin from Castor Valley. I registered to vote in 1975 when I was 18, and I voted in every single election since then. Because if you don't vote, you can't complain. And I like to complain.
Remember, you can find us anytime at Facebook and Twitter, and you can follow me at Tanzina Vega. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway. Have a great weekend. percent of Americans are Black, but they account for more than 40% of the homeless population.
There's this wild disparity here, and it's not simple enough to say that higher poverty rates among African Americans are the reason for it.
We're talking about why the rates of homelessness for people of color are so high and whether there are enough pathways out of it. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's next time on the Takeaway Podcast.